So, let's see which side. Well, so this, the title is actually even less technical than what the talk will actually be. So this will be a technical talk, and it's meant to be a technical talk. Essentially, this is a step in trying to determine to what extent what I call perturbation probes can help in determining the expansion history of the universe. As you know, this is a determining the expansion history of the universe is a, one of the major scientific problems, and I will not spend too much about that, about motivations. The idea is to, since perturbation depend in the linear regime, obey a linear equation, whose coefficients depend on the background. They depend linearly on the background in a functional form. So if you could find their time dependence, you could deduce the information on the background. Okay? So this is what I call a perturbation probe. And this hasn't been really pursued in a way that I will explain for various reasons. So this is the idea. This is what I mean by perturbation can help determine the expansion history of the universe. Now, to be able to actually do it in practice, we need an observable, a quantity that we can measure, and quantity that we can calculate reliably to compete with the background probes, which I will remind you of just a little bit later. This has to be done at the order of 1%. So we need to find a way of measuring a quantity that's related to the perturbation that we can calculate to 1% and measure to 1%. Now, typically, this requires that both can, this quantity is a quantity that we can calculate and measure in linear perturbation theory. That's why the cosmic microwave background is giving us such accurate information, because essentially most of the physics is linear. Then there are some nonlinear corrections, et cetera, et cetera. But the basic thing is that the physics is linear. So we have to find some quantity that will do that for perturbations as well. Obviously, galaxies are nonlinear, so there are. And the idea that I would like to present here is that the three-dimensional cosmic shear is such a quantity. So here's the plan, as I said, it will be technical. So what I want to do is this, right? Express the total equation of state parameter of a flat FRW universe in terms of derivative of the redshift dependent spin weighted angular moment of the 2-point correlation function of the three-dimensional cosmic shear. And the talk will essentially be, will explain this sentence and show that, hopefully, that it can be realized. Okay, so, and I will do it in two steps. First, I will express the total equation of state in terms of the metric perturbations in the conformal Newtonian cage for adiabatic perturbations with vanishing speed of sound. This is an interesting case. Other cases can be solved as well, but let me concentrate on this. And this is what I've done. The second step is to express the metric perturbation in terms of the derivatives of the angular moment of the shear correlation function. And the combination of these two steps will give me the desired relationship between the angular moments of the cosmic shear and the total equation of state for R. Okay, so that's my plan for the talk. Let me, again, as some kind of introduction, remind you of the problems, or why is it that I would like, that I need to go to background probes, which obviously are more complicated. And the reason is that, sorry, the perturbation probes. Background probes are quantities that can be, that are associated with the homogeneous and isotropic universe. All the classic geometric tests, the velocity distance, angular distance, a number of a number as a function of redshifts, et cetera, et cetera. So here is an example, just a reminder, of a how luminosity distance depends on the total equation of states. And this is, you see, it's a double integral. And to measure the total equation of state of the expansive history of the universe from luminosity distance, you have to be able to take two derivatives. One of them is logarithmic derivative. Okay? And this is, you can calculate numerically, analytically, how well this inversion works, and it doesn't work. Okay. So, and when you, there are different, various ways of overcoming this problem. One way is to assume some knowledge of the expansion history of things. That obviously helps in the inversion. That, in some sense, defeats the purpose of the exercise. You can combine various observables and improve the inversion, but it's not enough. Those of you that connect better emotionally to Grouse can see the same claims that, or the same statements that I made before on in Grouse. So they're essentially Grouse trying to show for a specific form of the expansion history the quality of the inversion, and you're supposed to see from the extent of the contours on this axis that the quantity, in this case, is some time derivative of the equation of state, cannot be measured well. Okay. So, and this is something that you cannot design an experiment that's based on these quantities to improve the accuracy. The reason why it is not possible to do that is a mathematical fact. It has nothing to do with experimental accuracy. First rule. Okay. So again, the last part of my introduction is just introducing the cosmic shear. I assume that some of you have heard the words and know something about it, but I assume that most of you don't really know what cosmic shear is. Correct me if I'm wrong. Okay. So the idea is to follow light from a distant object, typically a galaxy, through the perturbed universe. So the perturbation essentially give you a refraction index, make the universe have some non-trivial refraction index, and different light rays traverse different paths. In the homogeneous anisotropic universe, in the coordinates that I'm using for this, especially in flat universe, light rays travel on straight lines. Okay, we will see. So by looking at distortions of shape of distance object, you can, the distortion depends on the amount of inhomogeneities that you have. And typically, if you take a spherical shape, it can be distorted in a way that changes the volume of the shape. This is called convergence. And a distortion that is area preserving in this case and changes the ellipticity. That's here. And then there's rotation. And this is what happens here. The choice of colors is not very good. But you can see that the convergence kappa determines the new size of the circle, and gamma determines the ellipticity of the circle. Okay? So these are the quantities that we're after. And amazingly enough, this can be measured. It has to be measured statistically by looking at bunches of galaxies and looking statistically at their ellipticity distribution. And the first significant result has just come out. There are many, many big surveys planned for this type of measure. Because it really fits the description of depending on linear physics, and as I will show, it also, this is not apparent in the literature, but it can also be calculated in linear perturbation theory. So the two elements that are required to have a precision measurement are there. So by the way, I just realized that actually there is something like 10 collaborators, and one of them is QW, is not here this year. He's on sabbatical. It's my husband. So he is on this experiment. I will not, since this is not the topic of my talk, I will not explain many of the experimental details, but it's really into the force. And this shows, this is from a few months ago, and it shows actual detection results of a cosmic shear. So this first. Okay. Yes.
In late time cosmology, it's a nonlinear regime.
Yes.
So
we have to avoid that.
How do you do that? Because we have to look.
This I will explain. That's a key to being able to. That's why we need derivatives. Now, what I need, or what I will describe, is this three-dimensional cosmic shift. That's a two-dimensional, essentially two-dimensional measurement. So no redshift dependence or integration over redshift. Now, doing a three-dimensional galaxy survey, just counting galaxies, is just that. For example, the Sloan galaxy survey that I'm sure you've heard about is essentially a two-dimensional survey. They have some sub-small survey that's essentially an example of just feasibility experiment to show that you can do redshift dependence. But so far, even counting galaxies is not done as a function of redshift. Now, this, what 3D cosmic shear means, that you have to monitor the shapes of galaxies and their redshift. So it's really a major challenge. It is being designed as we speak, and there are several ways that people can think that they can do it. As I will show, to really do a good job, you have to. It's a major survey, say, to do this three-dimensional cosmic shift. Okay, so I'm done now with the introduction, and I'm going to part one of my talk, that's expressing the total equation of state in terms of the metric perturbation. Okay, that was the first step in the two steps that I was going to make. So here is the metric that I'm using. I'm many of the corporations that I represent can be generalized quite easily to non-zero special curvature, but since we know that the special curvature of our universe is not that different from zero, and since representation is much easier with special curvature equal to zero, that's what I do. So you see here, this is a FRW in conformal time. See that light rays propagate on straight lines. These are the Friedmann equation and the other equation. I put the conservation equation here. It's not an independent equation, but I will use it later for some changes of variables. So you should remember that. A prime is the derivative with respect to eta, and h is the derivative. It's a prime over a. Okay. So it's in cosmic sign, it's a dot. Now, going to the perturbed universe, obviously the metric is not a Gaussian quantity. We have to fix a gauge, and there are different ways of doing that. And the gauge that I will be using is called the conformal Newtonian gauge. And it's specified by one function of eta and x naught. Here, it's an inhomogeneous universe. And you see that the eta, g eta eta, is related to the other g's, like so. Phi is what I call the metric perturbation. Yes?
So tell me, why did you neglect anisotropic stress?
Because, well, this is a gauge. I don't understand what.
Oh, in general, you have two scalar functions, psi and phi.
Yes, but well, as you will see,
anisotropic stress is not a gauge.
Yes, that's true. As you will see, I will further. I will actually go to the case where there is no pressure at all. So I will go to a pressureless. But this is a. I don't have a very good argument now. Why I did that. It's just
because of the late time evolution of perturbations that can induce errors of the order of 10%, actually.
Okay, so let's keep this question in mind and see what happens later. Okay, so in this case, the equation, I can write the equation of motion for the perturbation phi in this way. This is completely standard. And if I take now the pressure, express the pressure in terms of the delta P in terms of delta rho and delta S, the entropy perturbation, I get this expression, CS squared is the speed of time of the perturbation. And what I want to assume now, well, okay, so I'm not assuming that. I'm assuming adiabatic perturbation. Again, it's because for calculation and convenience, and also because non-adiabatic perturbations cannot provide a large amount of the perturbation you see according to the background experiments. And combining these two equations, I get one linear equation for the perturbation. Okay, again, standard. So this is it. This is the equation. And I'm, again, using this. Okay, so what I want to do now is get rid of this friction-like term by a change of variables. And the way I do it is I change to the variable mu defined in this way. It actually works for non-zero space curvature as well. And I get a linear equation for u without a first derivative. And this quantity theta, it's like a potential, is given in terms of the total equation of state, like so. Now, I want to assume that the perturbations are present. The reason that why this assumption is reasonable is because if you follow them, they are the ones that are largest. So if I want to look at, let's say, what happens starting from redshift to 3, 4, 5, they would be the largest set of perturbations. Or if you wish, I'm assuming that if there is a dark energy component, it doesn't have perturbations. This is an approximation, has to be checked. But I think it's a reasonable approximation. OK, so in this case, you see what happens is that I can solve this equation. I can solve it also for the case of non-zero in CS squared. And in this case, I get a very simple solution for you of this equation. And I can identify the growing solution, which, for example, its matter domination is actually a constant solution. And I will be focusing on the largest piece of this solution. This will be the source of my perturbation. OK. So here is, this is what we ended up in the previous slide. And now, I would like to express this growing solution in a nicer way, eventually bringing it into an integral over redshift rather than conformal. So the way I do it is I first go from eta to rho. And I use the conservation equation to relate the eta to this quantity, the rho over h, rho plus e. And then I can express the growing mode of the perturbation as an integral zero. Then I can do a further change of variables, which, if you wish, the usefulness can be seen here. Again, using the conservation equation to compute d lambda chi, essentially. And what I get is an expression that looks simpler in terms of this new time fuse. And you can see explicitly that in this case, the perturbation factorizes into a time-dependent and a space-dependent part, like so. Okay, so you can see already here how this growing mode of the perturbation is expressed in terms of the equation of state. And the next transparency will make it clear. So now the next step is to express this variable chi going to redshift instead of redshift intervention rather than this variable chi. And the way I do it, first I look at what chi is in terms of cosmic time. And this is what it comes out to be. Now, the range of chi you can see from here, that chi equals 0 corresponds to very early redshift. Chi equals 1 is today. And I can now transform this integral. Right? So now, if I want to find the perturbation as a function of z, this is what I need. I get this Jacobian here, and I need to compute it. I can compute using the conservation equation. And I finally get a differential equation for phi in terms of z, which, right, it's a first order linear differential equation for phi. And if I put in this integration factor, I can express phi explicitly as an integral over z. It's factor contained in the equation of state. And I can invert that to get a relationship between the total equation of state as a function of z and the time dependent part or the redshift dependent part of the perturbation. Okay, so this is, I'm not going in an explicit way through the algebra, but I think that you can get the idea.
So
what is the subscript t? T is the time dependent thing. So phi was I called, right. So when I know, but you could see that it factorizes previously because that piece of the ground solution was factorizing, and I called the time dependent piece phi t. And the space dependent is call it C. I will deal with it later.
So was that factorization essentially because the C is down to zero?
Yes. Yeah. Now, if it doesn't, you can still solve the equation. And there is an analogous factorization. The thing that happens is that if this the components whose speed of sound does not vanish has perturbations that typically are suppressed with respect to a component that whose speed of sound vanishes. Because it's like the pressure. You get an oscillating wave, and that oscillating wave typically indicates like the power of the scale factor in an experience. So, but you can do it also for, in principle, also for non-vanishing spheres, and get the solution in terms of the Bessel functions. So you get the combination of Bessel function and then.
On the next slide, you end up with expressions that, so to my eye, they all look that different than, you know, expressions you wrote for the luminosity distance. I mean,
yes, okay. Right. So eventually, there's no way out of taking derivative. That's what I'm saying. You have to take derivative. And the only question is, which quantity is easier to take derivative?
So you're going to comment later on the improvement that we've achieved here?
Yes. But this is not the main subject of the talk. So what I want to do today is just present the expressions, the relationship. So the analog expression that to the L that I wrote in the first slide, I want to present it for the cosmic shift. That's the purpose of my talk.
Yes. So excuse me, just to connect to yes. John's question. I mean, your lower integration limit on set here has, of course, to be ensured to lie within the linear regime still.
Yes.
So still, it's not obvious how you will go to the nonlinear regime. Right?
I want to avoid the nonlinear regime.
But you want to make a statement about the late time universe.
Right. So there are still, even in the late time universe, there are modes that are still.
That's
nonlinear. Yes. So I want to concentrate on these modes. This is different than the usual approach of people because the cosmic shift signal and other signals are larger in the nonlinear region. I want specifically to avoid that because what happens there is you have to model the nonlinear regime. When you model the nonlinear regime, I cannot imagine that you can make this model to an accuracy that is better than 10%.
Yeah, that explains somehow also why you didn't do any Fourier transform. You work on space time picture.
No, I will do Fourier transforms, but I will only want to concentrate on modes that are linear throughout.
But is that consistent? If you do a Fourier transformation, all modes have to be in the linear regime. If your analysis is consistent.
It's true that you can get some contribution from small k. So second order Fourier transform mixes the contribution. But in this case, I assume, and this is typically the case, that the contribution from the short scale, that you can actually measure a Fourier component of that is linear, and that the contribution from the nonlinear modes to second order to that Fourier component is small. Again, these are issues that need to be tackled, and but that's again one step beyond the level that I'm at.
I have a nice question. Just make sure I get the picture. So, so the other case where you don't have factorization is with massing retrieval. So the growth function becomes also a function of k. But are you saying you're working on a large scale so that the effect of the massive neutrinos are
typically, massive neutrinos are not a large component of the energy density of the universe. And if you look at perturbations, perturbations in them do not grow.
But then they cut out the spectrum.
Yes, so yeah. I will
use the N as a trough stress, which would make it actually necessary to consider two scalar functions, even as Newton controlled.
Okay, so we can discuss that separately. I'm very interested in that. What I will be using is essentially eventually a power law. So one power law step. Okay. If you want to put in a cutoff, that's okay. I haven't thought in any detail about making the next level, because that's, as you will see, it's complicated. Okay, so this is the first step. Now I change gear, and I want to see how to measure the linear perturbation path with cosmic shift. So you remember this picture. We have a shape of a distant object. It's distorted. On the background, you essentially get the separation vector. Here is essentially r times theta. I'm calling rw because that's the name, the usual name in the cosmic shift literature. So that's the usual quantity that you expect in linear perturbation theory. You have a transfer matrix, if you wish, that changes this separation vector by this quantity, this matrix A. And this matrix A is, the entries of the matrix A are the convergence and convergence kappa and the shear gamma. Gamma is in this form, gamma 1 plus I gamma. Okay. And I remind you that the effect of the convergence is to change the size of the the volume of the object, and the shear is to distort it without changing the volume. Okay. So I now want to calculate A. And the way I do it is I solve the geodesic deviation equation. If I have two light rays, I can write the geodesic deviation equation and solve it. It's a linear equation. So this is, it's a matrix equation, the way I wrote it, whose entries are essentially related to the Ricci. So some components of the Ricci tensor and some components of the Vi tensor. K is a wave vector along the light, along the ray, and epsilon is the transverse vector. And I can compute the entries using the perturbation, the Peter metric that I have. Now, those of you who look through the cosmic shear literature, this is not usually the way it's done. They have some complicated algorithm of calculating the Newtonian potential and connecting it. But you can just do it. The result for the shear actually comes out to be the same as the one that they use. And for the convergence, here the time derivatives up here. Okay, so these are the entries of the geodesic deviation equation. And I can now solve the geodesic deviation equation iteratively. So I have the Green function for the first order, and this is the solution for A to linear order. And there is the kernel here is essentially the same kernel here. Okay? So this is where we're at. We have the separation vector, the matrix, the transfer matrix, the kernel here in terms of the perturbation, and this determines the shear and the convergence and the shear, and these are the expressions. Okay, so this is the convergence. I will not continue to do any further calculation with the convergence, continue with the shear, and this is what it is. And you can see here that the integral now, this W is eta or z, this is the source, and this is the observer. So the light rays, here the light rays propagate all the way to you, and you have to cut off the region where they propagate through the nonlinear regime. That's where the relatives are. Yes.
I think one of the major problems of cosmology today is that if you take late time regime and you plug in the inhomogeneous cosmological solution, Einstein's equation, and then smooth it out, you're not going to get the same answer as plugging in a homogeneous solution, Einstein's equations, and then accepting it.
Okay, I'm not sure what exactly is the relevance to this. If this is the case, then what the cosmic shear measurement will show that this equation doesn't work. So you have a way of telling apart. I'm using GR in all the standard form, but this is in principle a way of testing it.
How do you know how it fails?
You have to try. If you have another theory, you have to calculate the same, do the same calculation and see if it works. I wouldn't know.
In the solar system, we have large density contrasts.
Yes.
For all those things.
Right.
And we know we can use linear perturbations. Perturbations are small. But this is not true for late time cosmology.
It's true.
Even though phi is less than zero, what we need to say you can use a linear perturbation. There's a lot of cosmology about this at present. So I don't understand how you avoid the not linear property.
Light propagates on the metric that I have a specific metric. I can calculate light propagation in this metric, and I can calculate the geodesic deviation equation. So I can compare two different. And that's what I'm doing.
No, the question was just, I mean, the linear perturbation theory should break down at some stage, either in terms of weight numbers. And so what
yes.
is the mathematical criteria for?
So at this point, you can't see it. This is what I've been telling you. You have to wait and see where it comes in and how I'm proposing to overcome it. So
interrupted.
Yes.
If you go back, you threw away the rotation in your transfer.
Yes.
Do you want to comment on that?
That, as far as I can understand, is something that cannot be measured. Because I'm concentrating on the measurable observables. But the experimentalists are very clever. They may surprise us.
Is there some sense that this shear is small? Maybe that's a related question.
Yes, it's very small. That's why they only started measuring it. The first significant measurement is from a few months ago. And they've been trying to do that for years and years and years.
Doesn't this somewhat justify your metric you took initially?
Yeah, the shear is small. Very small. to the point that it wasn't detected at all until a few months ago.
No, but still, I don't agree with that.
That's a different thing.
This doesn't justify it.
No, yeah, it's different.
You could calculate the power aspect of the patient population.
Okay.
And then you could calculate something like a mass variance related to this power spectrum. And if this is one, then the whole analysis breaks down.
Stefan, let's get to the point where we can actually discuss it with equations. Okay, so the first, so you see, now what I'd like to do is calculate the power spectrum of the ship 2.5. And as you can see here, the expressions that appear here look problematic. So the reason, so the shear, the point is that the shear is not a scale. So if I want to do an angular mode decomposition of it, I have to use spin wave spherical function, tensor wire. Okay? And if I define the sort of the so-called spin operator, this appears also in polarization analysis of the cosmic microwave background, is in fact the operator del square with this dash on it is the operator that appears here, and it acts on spherical spin weight spherical harmonic with spin weight x by, and it raises their spin weight. So it takes a scalar spherical harmonics and raises them by two vector spherical harmonics, etc. So I have to use this formalism. And in this formalism, the shear can be written as the second derivative, this second spin weight derivative of the perturbation. And I remind you that because the growing mode factorizes, this just works on the space-dependent part, the space-dependent part. And now I want to calculate two-point function of the shear. So this is what we had before. And here is the two-point function. I have to assume something about the spectrum of the primordial spectrum. And I assume that it's isotropic. So I assume that in Fourier space, the correlation function C of Q1, C of Q2 is proportional to delta of Q1 minus Q2 for the moment. Later on, I will assume a power spectrum. Okay, so in that case, I can write explicitly, these are the kernels that were before. This is the time-dependent factor. And these are the spin wave operators that act on the angular forms here in the exponent. And now, what I do is I expand the into the IQX in YLMs and Bessel functions. That's, again, standard expansion that you do. And now I have to act with the spin weight operators on the YLMs. When I act with the spin weight operators on the, right, so I need to act with the spin weight operators on the YLM, and each of them acts on a scalar YLM and gives a weight 2 and weight minus 2 a spin weight YLM, okay, with some factors that are given by the whatever these functions are. Now I can do the M, the summation over M, in the usual, in the same way that I do on spin wave 0 YLM, and I get this answer. So there are two integrals over the kernel here. There is an integral on momentum, and there's some angular piece. Now, I want, so this is what I had in expanded now as a sum over L of spin wave 2, wave 2. And the coefficient of the spin wave 2, wave N, I call 2CF. So this is the analog of the CLs of the cosmic microwave background. But because this is a tensor quantity, I have to use, it's better to use this quantity. This is the quantity that they should really have used in the polarization, but because they want to compare it to the scalar expansion, they don't use this one. But it's equivalent. There's nothing special about CL to C. So here, this is what I need to do. And these coefficients are like the CLs of the cosmic microwave. So here it is. They are expressed here in the form of an integral. And the next thing that I want to do is deal with this Q integral, and that's where we will start to be able to discuss the expression. So what I am assuming now is a power loop of this form, say for the primordial spectrum. This n is the scalar index, so n equals to 1. It's called a flat spectrum, as you know. Cosmic microwave background, the W map is claimed to have measured this to be close to 1, but not exactly 1. I will take, for the purpose of this calculation, n equals 1. Because, again, it's the results are very simple. And I think that, in any case, these type of measurement will not be very useful for determining n. So there wouldn't be much difference if I took. So now I'm doing this integral here. Okay? And I can actually do it analytically for n equal to 1, not equal to 1. And I'm getting here essentially a delta function in the. So I would be interested in L's that are large, but not very large. So let's say 100, 200. For these L's, the evolution is still linear. Definitely, if I use phi and not delta rho, you could ask later a question, but which I'm not absolutely sure about the answer. So I can actually do this this integral, and it would be interesting to see what happens if you cut it off in different ways or modify from power law. But for this simple power law, this is what I get. So a delta function in the U. So right, this is the expression I studied it. This is what I find for n equal to 1. And now I can do one of the U integrals. Okay, so this is my expression. Nick, this is my expression for the 2CL. Note that they have two redshift or distance arguments here. So it's a correlation, a true 3D correlation. Right? And so because of this delta, you see the integral, when one of them is larger than the other, the integral is cut off beyond the other. And I get this simple expression for the two CLs, which are in principle measurable. OK. And now comes. Now, if you look at this expression, you see that it's really logarithmically divergent at small u. That, of course, is an artifact of the calculation, but obviously it's dominated from small u. And if you go back to the original integral and check what does the small u correspond to, it's large q. So small u, small redshift is dominated by a large wave number, which is where I expect the problem. So I need to be useful. I either need to model that, but then as I was saying, it's unlikely that I will get an actually accuracy that I would need, or I need to calibrate. And the way I'm proposing to cutting it off is take the relative. So you take, so you see the two CLs depend on two distances. Now, it's enough to take one derivative, so make a difference in one of the derivatives, fix one of them, and take differences in the other. This already kills the divergence in it. It's like taking out the atmosphere. And if you actually want the phi in terms of the two CLs, you have to take two derivatives. Yes?
I mean, in some sense, probably I did not understand enough, but in some senses, it's related to the usual divergence of linear perturbation theory you have. I mean, if you calculate the transfer function for any perturbation, it's proportional to the logarithm of the co-moving wave number characterizing this perturbation. So always when you go to large k, you have a problem actually, and there are several solutions to it. I mean for the CMB, it's standard because of silk damping. For cold dark matter, there's always.
Yes, damping. So there is some physics. Obviously, there is some physics. This is not a real divergence, and there's some physics. Yes, but so what I'm saying is that if there are two ways now, either I know the physics and I am able to subtract it in a good way to be able to use this expression. But nevertheless, if I want phi, I have to take derivative, right? Or I have to get it off. And I'm not sure exactly, but that my suspicion is that because it's related to matter fluctuations here, this would be hard. Hard if I wanted to actually take the nonlinear regime into account. So do a model of the nonlinear regime. So here, this is different. It's essentially subtracting. And the way I subtract it is I subtract to the shear correlation function between W1, W2, and W1 plus delta W1 and W2. And if I truly have a 3D map, there are many of them that I can use. And so this is the part, I'm starting to answer your question. And then you note here that there are many L's that I can use. And all of them give me, apart from a known L-dependent factor, they give me phi. So it's the same. If you perhaps you notice that in the cosmic microwave background, the position of the first peak is known to 1%. So you may have wondered how can that be? This is this is limited by cosmic variance. The L is about 200, so 1/2 of 2 × 200 = 20. So that's 5% error. The reason that they can go down to 1% error is because they can combine all the L's, say 100 L's, around the first peak. So here, we can have the same type of finality. But the point is essentially that you have many, many more measurements when you are considering anisotropic quantities. In homogeneous isotropy, you have one, and in you have a CL, you have 2L+1. Now, you can't go to too high L's because you have non-linearities. So I would say 100, 200, 300, where things are scaled reasonably linear. So you can do a few hundred of these things. So here is, now this is the end of part two, and now I have to combine. So I have now phi as a function of this here. Yes?
Sorry, I interrupt. You still have speed of sound zero.
Yes.
Because if you, well, this matters, but if you look at the calculation of the acoustic peaks,
yes,
CMP is quite sensitive to the speed of sound. In fact, the speed of sound is zero, the whole underlying nominal oscillating part vanishes.
That is true.
So, if you don't.
I'm talking about perturbations on large scales, and if you wish, I can start them quite late. Way after.
A small L.
No. Yeah. So for smaller L's, but also later. Right? So essentially this perturbations that I'm looking, I'm starting to evolve my perturbation equation when the universe is already matter dominated. And setting the speed of sound to zero is essentially saying that the major component, the major component responsible for the perturbation is the quantum matter. Now, that may not be exactly correct, as Justin pointed out, and you can do some corrections to that, but at first approximation, it seems real.
Speed of sound proportional to the high intensity and to CMP. So, the fire intensity advantage, which is small, of course. Because it's important to determine the position of the first peak.
The peaks are irrelevant. The physics of the peaks is irrelevant to what
I'm saying. Can I ask, is there an obvious relation between these quantities, these C2Ls, and what people are measuring now? Are they
You remember the picture that I showed? I can show it again, perhaps. Okay, let's go.
If you want to do it later.
No, let's do that because it's. Okay. So this is the picture. And here you see gamma square of theta, meaning that essentially. It's a quantity related to these two CL. They don't analyze it in this form, first because it's a two-dimensional quantity, so it's essentially average over redshift. And it's not exactly, they don't analyze it using this spherical harmonic, but just do some, take some top hat functions of they do an integral over the. But this quantity is related to Magnus. Okay.
Sorry, what was the? So that's 10 arc minutes on the theta is this theta.
Yeah, that's what they measure. Because it's a hard measurement and they are just starting, they measure a smaller region of the sky, and so they cannot measure very large areas. Okay, so 10 arc minutes is L of 360. 1 arc minute is about 3,000. But L, 1 degree is about L of 6. I never get it right, so I hope I correct this one. Okay, so where was that?
Said with confidence.
Yes. And where am I? Okay, so this we went through. Okay, so now I want to combine the two expressions that I have for W total in terms of phi and 4-5 in terms of the 2CF into one expression. I can't really do that in an explicit way, but I can do it in a way that is enough for any reasonable practical purpose. The first thing to do is to change variables from this W or R to Z, because that's the measurable quantity. Now, for this metric, W is eta essentially for light, and DL is 1 plus Z times R, 1 plus eta W, so W is DL of Z over 1 plus Z. This, by the way, shows that to make use of this calculation, you have to measure DL of Z also. So here is 5. So now I know W in terms of Z, I know 5 in terms of W, and I know of 5 in terms of CL, and I know W in terms of 5. So I could plug in expressions, they look quite complicated, but this is a relationship between W and the CLs. Okay, so this is what I promised I will do, and I did that. Now let me explain what I think are the consequences. Unless there are perhaps, if there are questions here. Okay, so my first point is that I did cosmic shear analysis, but in general, I think that perturbation probes are useful, and we have to do it. Otherwise, we'll get stuck with the results of the homogeneous and isotropic universe, which are not good. That they are in principle, they can be done because it's essentially the physics of light propagation in the perturbed universe is something that we know. Whether we know it to 0.1% or to 1%, that's an interesting question, but we can know it to 1%. Calculating perturbation theory, cosmological perturbation theory to 1%, we can do, for example, by adding, we can improve that by adding several other effects, and we can do it to 1% as the cosmic matter background. So I would say that perturbation probes are useful, and they will are the way to go. 3D shear is, to me, the most interesting quantity. I'm not sure because I haven't done the other probes, but it's interesting because it's really the intrinsic physics, at least in some of the regime of parameter space, is linked. And they seem to be able to control systematic effects quite well, and that's typically something that will get improved as measurements improve. Now, of course, one has to actually see whether this type of expression can, to what extent they help quantitatively resolve the expansion history of the universe. This is not the subject of my talk. I haven't discussed that. This is coming up, and I'm optimistic. Now, point about the measuring this, and this is essentially related to the questions that Rob asked and others. Because the cosmic shear measurement can be improved significantly by statistics. So just measuring lots of galaxies, it can be improved. And you could see the improvement going on in the same way that cosmic microbe has the measurement improved. They understood better what they are doing. I think that this is possible because what you need is essentially measure shapes of galaxies and redshift. So these are two measurements that you can do in principle.
I guess the question that's been bothering you all along is you need presumably a large survey.
Yes.
And spectroscopic redshift.
Exactly. So that's
very.
It's a very challenge.
SVSS only measures a very small fraction.
That is true. That is true. They don't really measure. And as you saw, what you really need is to get, let's say, 1% measurement of phi. You need 1% measurement of redshift and 1% measurement of px. So it's a challenging measurement. But it will have to be done.
So do you have a sense on things like LSST?
So for example, if you look, so that this is a complicated question. I can tell you that, for example, this SNAP design include, they essentially want to do that. The weak lensing part is a 3D redshift, it's a 3D measurement. The only thing, the problem is that they plan now to measure redshift photometrically. Okay, that's not good enough for these purposes. So, and in addition, as I was showing, to get some good expressions for good dissolving power, you need to know dl, the velocity distance. That you can do differently, but you still need to do to know it. So you can, it's essentially because you're solving a geodesic deviation equation, so you need to know the zeroth order. If you don't know the zeroth order to the accuracy that you want to calculate, you will not do the first order. But to me, this is very optimistic news because for a while I thought that it would be impossible. But if you look at the usual modes, the usual probes, you cannot, in principle, well, with any reasonable accuracy of measurement, you cannot measure local variations of the expansion history in any way. You just cannot. And so in that sense, this is a very optimistic message. That yes, it's a very challenging, but in principle, there is a quantity that can tell you how to do that, and that in principle is not something that requires different technologies. For example, if you wanted to measure H dot, so Avi Lev, and I think also Paul suggested looking at distant galaxies and seeing how Z changes. So that requires collection of light by 100-meter telescope for 100 years. Okay? So this, you should compare that to this type of thing, which is measuring the positions and redshift or shapes and redshift of a million galaxies, for example. So now, presumably, initially they will not be able to do the full thing, but it's still something that is, in my mind, feasible. It's something that you can do. And it will be done, one way or another. And the other thing is that is to really extract the expansion history or some useful knowledge about the expansion history, you have to be able to combine in a good way results from different experiments. No single experiment will be able to do that. And this requires, in terms of observing policies and the social practices of astronomers, requires essentially a revolution because they are not used to sharing data. They consider the data as private, and this will. So there are lots of challenges on the way, but they will have to be met. Okay, thank you.
How much control do you have over the approximations that you make? I mean, you want these measurements to be within 1%, but I didn't know that your error that in your that it is in your theory less than that.
Okay, so in so I could only know the errors if I can add an effect and check to what extent it influences my result. Okay. So, for example, I mentioned the n different from 1. So that, since that calculation I can do, I'm in the process of actually evaluating explicitly, and I can get an expression for the deviation. If the deviation is larger than 1%, then I should include, and I can include. For example, anisotropic pressure. That I can also include. It modifies my equations, but I can still do it, and I can check to what extent adding anisotropic pressure changes my results and for which values of the parameters. So in that sense, the calculation that I presented here is the first step. If it turns out that there are additional parameters that need to be included, for example, you know, a Kappa-Fonda spectrum. Right. As you could see, a cutoff should not really change much the properties, but it can be estimated quantitative. So I can change the shape of the spectrum. I can do the integral over the vector, and I can check to what extent the result changes. And if it changes, I can include it in this. Essentially solving cosmological perturbation theory, and that is something that can be done.
The nice thing with this cutoff position would be that close to the cut of the power spectrum will have a maximum. And that would give you a handle, you could really find it mathematically for which modes, how long your calculation holds.
Yes.
So the definition of linear regime, basically.
Yes. So in that sense, my personal perspective would be to stay away from this region.
But you want to check that you are aware.
Right, exactly. So that, again, this is something that can be done in principle. So I don't see an obstacle of reaching 1% accuracy on the theoretical side of the calculation. And that's perhaps that's harder to estimate, but, and this is something that I should check again. But I don't see a problem of a principle other than money and reasonable time to get to 1% measurements or cosmic variance limited measurements of these two CMs for this shift.
Just a comment about this quasi-linear, or you know, this. So you know, there's in the shear, there's also information, say, about galaxy clusters.
Yes.
You can, I mean, people, you can do power spectrum of galaxy clusters, and that's sort of the quasi-linear.
Okay. So let me explain the comment in also. So there's much more physics that you can do with Wittlenz in cosmic shear. Because, for example, on much smaller scales, in addition to the gravitational interactions, you also have light interacts with matter. The analog of the isotropic of all time. Right? So you can do many other measurements. They are very interesting on their own sake because light first approximation. Matter is neutral, is only sensitive to the total amount of energy density. So it's an interesting measurement by itself. But for my purposes, my point is that you have to avoid this region. So this is something that probably will not be useful
because the modeling of the physics there is likely to introduce errors that are, I would say, getting down to 10% would be a variance. Because you need, for example, a model of collapse. As far as I know, it's hard to get to 10%, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's, if you want to really look at the nonlinear, you have to have a model estimating from, it's like this BBK, whatever, this one, two, and Berlin, estimating how from a linear power spectrum you get cracks. That goes into the simulation, et cetera. And that induces errors that I think will kill the usefulness of this regime for this purpose. There's much, much more physics to which I think we can make sure that it's there for other purposes. Yes?
It's getting back to this issue of integration theory. The CAD is a density contrast is tending minus 5.
Yes.
We can use a linear perturbation theory. We don't have to calculate the constant.
Yes.
However, we have to see what's going on 13.7 billion years ago through the nonlinear regime, because we only see things through D sub L, light rays. Right? So,
yes.
So, if you, I mean, this is a problem with WMAP3, what about the Fulcrum problems?
Okay, so.
So, if you dealt with a nonlinear regime, an inhomogeneous solution of Einstein's equation, you may not get the same answer as you do. Starting with sitting in ZRW, which it isn't data, and then it puts something in. So your 1% depends on this issue.
I would say that that's
a principal issue.
Yes. So let me make two comments. First of all, there are much worse problems in measuring what we share, for example, the atmosphere. It's a much bigger disturbance than the perturbations on the wind, right? So you have to subtract. And apparently they can do it. And if you go to space, you can probably do it even better, but you have another. So the problems of subtracting the late universe are similar to the problem of subtracting the atoms. That's one comment. The other comment is that I'm not claiming that FRW is the correct description of our work. What I'm saying is that if this is the correct description, then this is what I should get. And my point is that this can be measured. So if it turns out that the results are different than what I suggested, for example, GR may not be the correct theory. Why go to FRW? GR may not be the correct theory. Then my calculation is irrelevant because I have to use another theory to find the cosmological perturbation. And in that case, you will have to redo that calculation. So if these assumptions are incorrect, one will have to redo the calculation. I assume that the results are different, and so there's an experimental way of telling them apart. So now, on Ls that are 200, if our W with the perturbation seems to be a pretty good approximation. That's
okay, more questions?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.